4. Echoes of the past. There is a saying, a duck's quack doesn't echo and no one knows the reason why. Hoping to disprove this one slow afternoon at the office, I found myself semi-prone on a grassy knoll, pretending to interview a duck named Daisy. Every time she quacked or stretched and opened her wings, camera shutters fluttered like castanets. My colleagues stood close by, unable to contain their laughter. The press had caught wind of our modest attempt to correct the misconception about the supposed non-echoing quack, and were doing their best to turn it into an international news event. Little did I know that, a few years after fronting this frivolous science story, I would once again become engrossed in echoes, rediscovering the childlike pleasure of finding places where a yell resounds with satisfying fidelity to the original. But there is more to echoes than shouting in tunnels or yodeling in the mountains. Depending on the type of echo, sound can return magically distorted. Claps turning into chirps, whistles, or even zaps from laser guns. Early documenters of natural phenomena, such as the 17th century English naturalist Robert Plot, used fantastic terms such as polysyllabical, tonical, manifold, and tautological to describe the mystery of echoes. But while the cataloguing of animals and birds has survived to the present day and still captures interest, the same is not true of echoes. It is time to revive the echo taxonomy. Can an echo turn a single word into a sentence? Or return the voice adorned with a peculiar musical note? Or even transpose a trumpet tune, with each repeat being at a lower frequency? A few months before the photo shoot with Daisy, Danny McCall, the laboratory manager at Salford University, had been approached by BBC Radio 2 to find out whether the phrase, "a duck's quack doesn't echo," was true or false. Ignoring Danny's careful explanation of why a quack will echo, the factoid was still broadcast. Annoyed that his acoustic prowess had been overlooked, Danny and some of his colleagues, including me, decided we needed to gather scientific evidence to prove the point. Convincing a farm to lend us a duck and transporting it to the laboratory were probably more time-consuming than the actual experiments. First, we placed Daisy in the anechoic chamber and made a baseline measurement of an echo-free quack. The anechoic chamber is an ultra-silent room where sound does not reflect from the walls. It is without echoes, as the name implies. It was important to have a reference sound without echoes. After all, this was a serious piece of science and not a bit of Friday afternoon fun. After a brief comfort break for Daisy, she was carried next door to the reverberation chamber, which sounds like a cathedral with a very long reverberation time, despite being little bigger than a tall classroom. Normally, the chamber is used to test the acoustic absorption of building parts like theatre seating or studio carpets. In this room, Daisy's quacks sounded evil and ghostly as they echoed around the room, the noise prompting her to cry out again and again. We had created the ultimate sound effect for a horror movie, provided the film featured a vampire duck. An echo is a delayed repetition of sound, which for a duck might be caused by a quack reflecting off a cliff. The vampiric cry in the reverberation chamber demonstrated that quacks reflect from surfaces like every other sound. We were not surprised by the result, not least because there are bird species that echolocate, using wall reflections to navigate caves. The great Prussian naturalist and explorer, Alexander von Humboldt, wrote about one of these species, the oil bird, a nocturnal frugivore, fruit eater from South America. On a visit to the Guacharo cave in Venezuela in the late 18th century, Humboldt experienced the squawking and clicking of the roosting birds. The clicks are the echolocation signals. The birds listen to the reflections to navigate in the dark. But caves and reverberation chambers are not a natural habit for ducks like Daisy. We were curious to know what happens outdoors. To hear a clear single echo from Daisy, I would need a stretch of water with a large reflecting surface, such as a cliff, nearby. In such a place, sound would travel directly from the duck to my ear, followed shortly by the delayed reflection from the cliff. In the taxonomy of echoes, this is a monosyllabic echo, where there is just time to say one syllable before an echo arrives. But Daisy and I could not be too near the cliff, or my brain would combine the reflection with the quack travelling directly from her beak to my ear, and I would hear only one sound. I must admit that my field experiments were crude. Though I could not bring Daisy, I did wander around various ponds, canals, and rivers listening to wildfowl. In none of these places could I hear a clear, audible quack separate from the original call. In the end, I came to the conclusion that the phrase should say, "A duck's quack might echo, but it's impossible to hear unless the bird quacks while flying under a bridge." Maybe I should have taken Daisy to Lake Königssee in Bavaria, Germany's highest lake, where rock faces rise steeply out of the water. Boat captains there play short phrases on trumpets so that tourists can hear the last three notes repeat, delayed by 1 or 2 seconds after bouncing off the surrounding Alps. Or perhaps I should have taken Daisy to the place where 17th century French theologian, natural philosopher, and mathematician Marin Mersenne had carried out his echo experiments. He used a polysyllabic echo to make the first accurate measurements of the speed of sound in air. Nowadays, Mersenne is probably best known in mathematics for his work on prime numbers, but he was also passionate about a wide variety of subjects and devoted to the need for experimentation and observation. Unsurprisingly, Mersenne did not use wildfowl in his speed of sound experiments. Instead, he stood facing a large reflecting surface, saying the words, "Benedicam Dominum," and using a pendulum to time the sound. Mersenne must have been a quick talker, because he said this 7-syllable phrase in 1 second. When he stood 485 royal feet, 159 meters from a large reflecting surface, the echo immediately followed the end of the original phrase, "Benedicam Dominum, Benedicam Dominum." This is a polysyllabic echo, because many syllables can be said before the echo returns. The echoed words had covered a round trip of 2 times 485 royal feet, a total of 319 meters, allowing Mersenne to deduce that 319 meters per second is the speed of sound. This is remarkably close to the correct value of about 340 meters per second, 761 miles per hour. Now, if Mersenne had used a duck, he could have stood nearer the wall and still heard a distinct quack quack, because a duck's call is but one syllable. In fact, the distance to hear a monosyllabic echo like a quack is about 33 meters, 36 yards from a reflecting surface, 660 duck feet, because at that distance an echo takes just long enough to bounce back that it can be heard separately from the original sound. To hear a quack echo, I would need to find a stretch of water with a large building or cliff about 30 to 40 meters or 30 to 40 yards away. But even this would not work, because a duck's quack is too quiet. Sound becomes quieter the farther you are from a source, by 6 decibels for every doubling of distance. So if a quack measures 60 decibels 1 meter, 3¼ feet from the beak, 2 meters 6½ feet away, it will have dropped to 54 decibels. 4 meters 13 feet away, it will be at 48 decibels, and so on. By the time the reflected quack has undertaken its round trip of 66 meters, 72 yards, the echo will be about 24 decibels. In a completely silent place, a human could hear this, but more often other noises, such as the distant rumble of traffic or wind moving through trees, are louder, making the quack inaudible. Sadly, even in a silent place, Daisy would not be able to hear the echo, because her hearing is less sensitive than a human's. So the reason the echo from a duck's call is not heard is pure physics. A quack is not loud enough to be heard after it makes the return trip from the required distance. Marin Mersenne's acoustic work extended beyond the speed of sound. He also debunked fanciful tales about 400 years before myth-busting became a popular pastime on television. One of the more extravagant acoustic claims in classical literature is a supposed heterophonic echo that, when spoken to in French, replied in Spanish. Mersenne knew this could not be true, but as Professor Frederick Vinton Hunt wrote in his seminal book, Origins in Acoustics, Massen almost convinced himself that one could devise a special series of sounds whose echo might lead a listener to think he had heard the response in a different language. The term heterophony comes from musicology and denotes a melody being simultaneously played with an elaborated variant. So I can only imagine that a heterophonic echo might augment the French words to make them Spanish. Unfortunately, no one knows for sure what was meant by the term, and there are no examples of heterophonic echoes. Luckily, there are other literary games that can be more successfully played with echoes, as I found out in France. One hot, sunny day in 2011, I was cycling with my family in the Loire Valley, and we arrived at the Château de Chinon. The heart of the castle was built by Henry Plantagenet, who would later become King Henry II of England. But I was more interested in a very unusual road sign just outside the castle walls. It points up at a small lane and simply says, "Echo." How could a collector of sonic wonders resist this invitation? A few hundred yards up the lane was a small raised turnout and a sign indicating that this was the place to test the acoustics. I yelled and yodeled and appreciated the fine echo. What made the experience very satisfying was that the side of the chateau, which was reflecting the sound, was partly hidden by an orchard, so the clarity of the echo was surprising. I could not resist attempting a traditional piece of echo humor from my guidebook to the Loire. Me, les femmes de Chinon sont elles fidèles. Echo, elle? Me, oui, les femmes de Chinon. Echo, non. This translates into English as, me, are the women of Chinon faithful? Echo, them? Me, yes, the women of Chinon. Echo, no. Given the right enunciation, with an unnatural stress placed on the last syllable in each phrase, such as the non in Chinon, the rhyme worked. By that I mean that the partial words echoed back from the north side of the chateau and were clearly audible. The sentiments expressed in the poem could not be readily verified. There are other echo stories. Here is a 19th century account from Wonders of Acoustics by Rodolphe Rado, with a Latin translation in square brackets. Cardan tells a story of a man who, wishing to cross a river, could not find the ford. In his disappointment, he heaved a sigh. "Oh," replied the echo. He thought himself no longer alone and began the following dialogue. "Ond devo passar? Hence I have to pass. Passar? Pass. Qui? Here? Qui? Here. However, seeing he had a dangerous whirlpool to pass, he asked again. Devo passar qui? I have to pass here? Passar qui? Pass here. The man was frightened, thinking himself the sport of some mocking demon, and returned home without daring to cross the water. Wonders of Acoustics includes much about Athanasius Kircher, a 17th century Jesuit scholar based in Rome, who wrote extensively about theatre acoustics and other marvels. He was intrigued by manifold echoes, echoes that produce multiple distinct reflections. Included in this category are repeating echoes caused by elaborate structures that turn one word into a whole sentence. For his two-volume masterpiece, Masergia Universalis, from 1650, Kircher produced a drawing of large upright panels, spaced at various distances from a talker, to generate a series of reflections arriving one after another. One such edifice had five panels and was designed to take the word clamore and break it down to echo clamore from the first panel and amore from the second, followed by more, ore, re from the third, fourth, and fifth surfaces respectively. So if you shouted the question, "Tibi vero gratias agam, quo clamore?" How shall I cry out my thanks to thee? The echoes from the last word would reply with a Latin phrase, clamore, amore, more, ore, re, which roughly translates as, with thy love, thy wont, thy words, thy deeds. I thought this seemed very unlikely to work, but the idea was intriguing enough to inspire a quick test. Not having five large panels lying around, I decided to try out the idea by simulating the situation on my computer. I recorded myself saying clamore and then, using a piece of prediction software, estimated the reflections returning from each of the panels shown in Kircher's picture. I played around with how far the panels were from the speaker and the loudness of the reflections in an attempt to produce the echo pattern. Much to my surprise, the echo phrase actually worked, but perhaps only because my brain was fooled into hearing patterns I wanted to hear. I once saw a great demonstration of a similar effect by author Simon Singh, based on the accusation that Led Zeppelin hid satanic messages in Stairway to Heaven. If you play the track backward, you supposedly hear, "Oh, here's to my sweet Satan. The one whose little path would make me sad, whose power is Satan. He'll give those with him 666. There was a little tool shed where he made us suffer, sad Satan." So concerned were some religious groups that various US states introduced legislation requiring records to carry warning labels. These claims further implied that even when records were listened to normally, with the sound playing forward, the listener would subconsciously decipher the meaning of the backward satanic messages. Several groups of psychologists have tested the claims using proper scientific methods. Experiments show that if you listen to Stairway to Heaven backward with your eyes closed, what you actually hear is gibberish. These satanic lyrics are heard only if you have a printed version in front of you. You can try this out yourself. Plenty of websites are dedicated to backward masking with sound samples. The brain has to make sense of incomplete information all the time, so it is very adept at finding patterns and fitting together different sources of information. But sometimes the brain gets it wrong, in this case matching the written lyrics to the otherwise incomprehensible backward murmurings. The same thing happens with the clamore, amore, more, ore, r echo. When I listened very carefully for this pattern of words, I could pick out the phrase. The effect was especially strong if the echoes were faint and I was forced to strain to hear them. But if I closed my eyes and listened more holistically and analytically, the dominant effect I could hear was many repetitions of r. The clever wordplay disappeared. A multiple echo, or tautological echo, is almost the same as a manifold echo, except the same words or syllables are repeated many times. An episode of the TV show The Simpsons features this phenomenon as a piece of oral slapstick. Marge is in church and yet again is being embarrassed by Homer. She cries out, "Homer, your behavior is heinous!" And a tautological echo replies, "Anus, anus, anus." Athanasius Kircher was also interested in echo pranks. He describes being amused at a friend's expense in the Campagna at Rome, a lowland plain surrounding the city. His friend cried out, "Quod tibi nomen?" What is your name? And the echo impossibly replied, "Constantinus." The conceit was achieved using an accomplice hiding near a cliff where normally there was no echo. The accomplice would shout out the reply after hearing the question, impersonating the improbable sound reflection. A more impressive practical joker is Bob Perry, who has taught himself to impersonate an echo. He does an impressive performance of John F. Kennedy's inaugural address, complete with multiple renditions of each word, as though caused by a public address system. With a little practice, you could teach yourself to do this. Select a spoken passage in which the space between syllables is a little longer than normal, as in JFK's speech, because of the slow delivery, and then say every syllable twice. Ask, ask, not, not, what, what, you, you, can, do, do. To make it convincing, the echo words should be a bit quieter. It is not usually the architecture that renders big speeches and announcements in train stations unintelligible. Often electronics are to blame. Bad public address systems send out sound too loudly from too many sources. You hear words from two or more loudspeakers arriving separately because these sources of sound are different distances from you. One engineering solution is to change the position and orientation of each loudspeaker to make sure you hear only one at a time. Engineers can also use loudspeakers that illuminate defined areas rather than speakers that radiate in all directions. The aural equivalent of using a spotlight instead of a general-purpose light bulb. But targeted illumination is not always possible, in which case engineers add electronic delays to each speaker to ensure that you hear all versions of the speech arriving at roughly the same time. Your brain will then lump the speech from the different speakers into one louder sound, minimizing the confusing cacophony of repetition. On the TV show Candid Camera, Echo prankster Bob Perry stood at Coit Tower, which affords great views of San Francisco, next to a full sign saying Echo Point. Standing alongside his unsuspecting victim, Bob shouted to create the illusion of sound bouncing off the tower, imitating an echo delayed by about 1/5 of a second. The joke was that whenever the victim tried shouting, there was no echo. Bob Perry is impersonating what music producers would call a slapback echo, which is a single loud and delayed repetition. This effect was popularized in rock and roll recordings from the 1950s and helped create the characteristic sound of famous singers like Elvis Presley. The audio engineers used two tape recorders to produce electronic echoes. A single big loop of the magnetic tape was fed through both recorders. The first machine would record the music onto the tape, and the second would pick up the sound from the tape a short time later, thus producing a delayed, slapback echo. The time between the passing of the tape under the record head on one machine to its reaching the pickup on the other machine determined the delay of the echo. On tracks such as Boogie Disease by Dr. Ross, the echo delay is about 0.15 seconds, creating the impression that the electric guitar on this blues recording is playing at double speed, as every strum is repeated. The same effect gave Elvis's vocals a distinctive sound on his recordings with Sun Records, such as Blue Moon. When Elvis switched to the RCA record label and achieved global hits with songs like Heartbreak Hotel, the sound engineers could not work out how to reproduce the slapback echo, and they resorted to adding heavy reverberation from a hallway outside the studio. Nowadays, it would be simple to reproduce this effect digitally, as delay is one of the cornerstones of modern pop production. To create the effect without electronics, RCA's engineers would have had to record Elvis in a studio next to a long tunnel or a tall room with a domed roof that had a slapback echo. Remember, one of the dimensions would have to be at least 33 meters, 110 feet, which would make it a rather large recording studio. The Imam Mosque in Isfahan, Iran, might have worked for Elvis's voice as, according to the old writings on echoes, it is a centrum phonocampticum, the object of an echo. Constructed in the 17th century, the building is visually stunning, with dazzling blue Islamic tiles. A huge dome rises to an exterior height of 52 meters, 170 feet, and, as one travel guide states, replicates individual sounds in a series of clear echoes. Tour guides delight in standing underneath the dome and snapping or flicking a piece of paper, which creates a short, sharp clack, clack, clack. The room immediately responds with about 7 quickfire echoes. Sound bounces back and forth between the floor and ceiling, with the curved dome focusing the sound, forcing it to keep moving vertically up and down in a regimented fashion. Without a dome, the echo from the ceiling would be lost among all the other sound reflections in the mosque. Luke Jerram is an artist who often uses sound as an art medium. His work Earless was inspired by a visit to Iran, where he heard the echoes in the Imam Mosque. I first met Luke about 7 years ago, when we both reached the finals of FameLab, a pop idol-style competition to find science presenters for the media. I caught up with Luke when Earless, or what he called my 10-ton musical instrument, was being installed outside my university's building at Media City UK in 2011. Earless looks like a section through a giant steel hedgehog, an arch 4 to 5 meters, 13 to 16 feet high, with 300 long, hollow steel pipes sticking out of the top and sides. The shape was inspired by the 12 stuttering echoes that Luke had heard when he clicked his fingers in the mosque. Stand in the right place under earless, and you can hear the focus from the arch subtly amplifying your voice. The light coming through the mirror-lined steel pipes creates geometric patterns echoing the decoration of the mosque. While the arch is the most obvious visual feature of the sculpture, the main sound effect is created by long wires that stretch almost invisibly from supporting poles to the hedgehog. Each of the wires is driven to vibrate by the wind. Pieces of wood act like violin bridges, transferring the string vibrations to membranes stretched across the ends of the pipes. The membranes then cause the air in the pipes to resonate. Overall, the result is an eerie, pulsing sound like a minimalist piece of music by American composer Steve Reich, in which tones come and go depending on the changing wind. The work is named after the ruler of the four winds in Greek mythology. Luke's intention is to use sound to paint pictures in people's imaginations, allowing visitors to visualize the changing landscape of wind around the artwork. The sound is hard to locate, appearing to be flowing vaguely from above. The lengths of the pipe are carefully selected to form a musical scale. Appropriately, the Aeolian mode is used, which, as a minor scale, lends a malevolent, spooky character to the sound. If I shut my eyes, I could imagine I was in a B-movie during a Martian invasion. Luke decided to construct Earless after meeting a master digger in Iran who had described the construction of underground irrigation canals called kanats. The digging is wet, claustrophobic, and dangerous. The worst task is probably devil digging, in which they mine up to a well of water from underneath. Just imagine being in a cramped passageway at the moment the digger breaks through and the water comes cascading down on top of you. What inspired Luke to create a singing building was the howling of a kanat's air vents in the wind. Like the Iranian mosque, many grand buildings feature domes, but only rarely do they have the right curvature to achieve distinct echoes. The room has a focal point that is too high. The building on the right brings amplified sound back to the listener at ground level and produces a pattern of repeated echoes. By measuring the time between echoes in a recording, I estimate that the interior height in the Imam Mosque is 36 meters, 120 feet. The place to stand in the mosque is marked on the floor. This spot is called the Centrum Phonicum, according to old writings on echoes. The surfaces of the floor and ceiling must also be made from materials that absorb little sound. The tiles of an Islamic mosque are ideal for two reasons. First, they are heavy, which means the sound wave is too weak to physically vibrate the tiles. Second, they are quite impervious to air, which means the acoustic wave cannot easily enter the tile and instead bounces off the front. The Brixton Academy in London started life as the Astoria Theatre, an Art Deco wonder from 1929. Film director Alfred Hitchcock was at the opening night, which featured Al Jolson's The Singing Fool. The Academy has an echo caused by reflections between the dome and the sloping floor, but the echo is heard only during sound checks when the auditorium is empty. When the hall is packed, sound is absorbed by the audience as it squeezes into the pores of people's clothing, where the wave then loses energy. For poorly attended concerts, the echo has the fortunate effect of compensating for the small audience by amplifying the applause. Brian Katz, a French academic and acoustic consultant, has been investigating, together with colleagues, an intriguing focusing ceiling from a long-lost room in Paris. The room has been linked to the thousands of executions carried out during the French Revolution. In the 19th century, Auguste Lepage wrote, "To this room devoted to meditation and prayer are linked bloody memories. It is there that was sitting the famous court during the September 1792 massacres." Lepage goes on to describe the room. Massive pillars supported a roof frame, which was a wonderful construction. This frame, rounded in a dome shape, was made from Spanish chestnut. No nails were used, and the 1,000 pieces that composed it were only fixed up by pegs. Though the room was destroyed in 1875, Brian is able to work with a 19th century replica a small-scale model conserved in the Musée d'Art et Métier in Paris. The ceiling looks like an upturned wicker basket that has been squashed almost flat. Seen from below, the roof forms rings of beams with gaps between. While the curvature focuses sound, the focal point is at the wrong height for human ears to hear the effect. The secret behind the acoustic is that the beams are spaced farther apart near the middle of the ceiling, coming closer together at the edges of the room. Brian has shown that at some frequencies, the reflections from the different beams combine to amplify the sound in the middle of the room. It is a quirk of geometry. The dome's wooden lattice resembles a Fresnel zone plate, named after the French physicist Augustin Jean Fresnel, who studied diffraction in the 19th century. Fresnel zone plates use diffraction to focus light. They can be used to focus laser beams, and recently have been suggested as a lightweight substitute for heavy lenses used in space telescopes. In acoustics, zone plates can be used to focus beams of ultrasound. Echoes are not just fun phenomena. They can be aids to safety. A couple of years after the Titanic sank, a quick-witted captain described how his freighter had escaped a similar North Atlantic fate while sailing in foggy weather off the Grand Banks of Newfoundland. A 5-second blast on his ship's foghorn resounded from the mist. But was this another steamer's call? The captain sounded a more elaborate pattern of blasts, which were exactly repeated back to him, revealing that this was an echo. The Day newspaper described how he took evasive action to avoid hitting a berg that he could feel and hear, but could not see. Another historical example of sailors using echolocation comes from Puget Sound in Washington State. An article in Popular Mechanics magazine from 1927 describes the inside passage from Puget Sound to Alaska as more crooked than the famous dog's hind leg, a narrow, tortuous channel. In foggy weather, navigators would locate themselves by listening to the echo of their steamboat's whistle. The strong tides in the channels made it impossible for the ship to move slowly, as would be done in foggy conditions out in open sea. As the same magazine article explained, the full steam ahead, followed by the full speed astern, is the rule of the echo pilots. If an echo was delayed by 1 second, the whistle would have travelled 340 metres, 370 yards, indicating that the boat was 170 metres, 185 yards from shore. Sailors learning to navigate the route had to memorise the reflection delays from key landmarks. On a small island that was too low to produce an echo, an 8-metre-square, 25-foot signboard was erected to aid navigation by reflecting a blast on the whistle. The magazine claims that the pilots identified the type of coastline from the echo. A low coastline returns a sizzling echo, while a high cliff gives a solid plunk. The echo scrapes from a beach of sand or gravel, and a forked headland yields a double echo to the expert ear. This claim strained credulity until I heard a talk by Norwegian acoustic expert Tor Halmrest, who had been carrying out experiments into echolocation by blind people. By making a clicking sound and listening to the sound of the reflections, people can learn to navigate with their ears, mimicking the techniques used by dolphins, bats, and oil birds. Daniel Kish learned to echolocate from a young age, and in New Scientist he described what a hectic school day was like for him at age 6. Clicking my tongue quickly and scanning with my head, I move cautiously forward. The sounds in front of me take on a softer hue, suggesting there's a big field of grass ahead. Suddenly, there is something in front of me. I stop. Hi. I venture, thinking at first that someone is standing there quietly, but as I click and scan with my head, I work out that the something is too thin to be a person. I realize it is a pole before I reach out to touch it. There are 9 poles all in a line. I later learn that this is a slalom course, and while I never attempted to run it, I practiced my biking skills by slaloming among rows of trees, clicking madly. The clicking is usually made by sharply dropping the tongue in the mouth, maybe with an accompanying suck or a short, sharp cluck. The exact sound is very individual, making it difficult for one person to echolocate using someone else's vocalization. The diversity of sounds one can make is amazing. A palatal click is a good one, made by a quick release of the vacuum produced between the tip of the tongue and the roof of the mouth. Being short and loud, it is easier to pick out in noisy places. The palatal click also contains sounds spread across many frequencies, which human echolocators find useful. Since they are listening for surfaces only a few yards away, and since most reflections from such surfaces arrive too quickly to be heard distinctly, these people must learn to detect subtle changes between what is heard by each ear. The interference of the click and its reflection might cause coloration, a change in the frequency balance, alerting the tonal quality or what musicians call timbre. The reflection might elongate the original click, for example, suggesting a reflection from a nearby surface. The effect depends on the distance from the reflecting surface, which alters the delay, and also on how the object reflects acoustic waves. Larger objects reflect low frequencies more strongly. Soft objects tend to absorb sound and so produce weaker reflections. Studies show that even novice echolocators can learn to distinguish square, triangular, and circular shapes with minimal practice. Some of the most extraordinary echoes come from man-made structures. Engineered curves can focus echoes, and parallel flat walls can encourage sound to bounce back and forth in a way that is unlikely to happen with natural surfaces. Bridge arches have great potential to be sonic wonders, as I found out on a canoeing trip on the Dordogne River in France a couple of months before seeing Earless. One stone arch was just the right size and shape to put the focal point at the water level, and slapping my paddle on the water created a wonderful ricocheting sound. During the lunch break, I explored under another bridge over a sandbank. Standing with my back to the edge of the arch and clapping my hands produced a stunning fluttering sound, a multiple echo. Across the Atlantic in Newton Upper Falls in Massachusetts, a similar fluttering sound under an aqueduct proved so remarkable that denizens named it Echo Bridge. Built in the 1870s, this 40-meter-wide, 130-foot arch spans the Charles River and even has steps down to a specially built platform so that visitors can test out the sound effect. The internet has several videos of dogs being driven mad by their own echoes, believing there to be a rival canine on the other side of the river. Not only does the bridge attract tourists and playful dog owners, it also intrigues scientists. In September 1948, Arthur Tabor Jones wrote to the Journal of the Acoustical Society of America, detailing a small study. A hand clap is returned in a series of about a dozen echoes of decreasing loudness, and at a rate of about 4 echoes per second. Jones describes elaborate experiments undertaken to determine what is causing the reflection. The question Jones was trying to answer was whether the sound was skimming around the inside of the curved arch, like the whispering galleries I describe in the next chapter, or propagating horizontally just above the water. He unsuccessfully tried using listening trumpets to determine which direction the sound was coming from. Further attempts using blankets to block off sound going around the arch failed because of high winds. Unable to get to the bridge myself, I found photos and postcards that allowed me to estimate the shape of the archway. I calculated the echo delay from video soundtracks of dogs barking. And finally, modern prediction methods allowed me to visualize how the sound moves. Each snapshot shows the roughly semi-circular shape below the arch, where the platform is to the left and the water is the long flat line at the bottom. Starting from the top left frame, the dots show how sound moves from the talker across to the far side of the bridge and back again. To make this animation, I modeled sound as lots of tiny snooker balls, which are fired in all directions from the platform. The computer works out how the balls bounce around the odd-shaped billiard. The sound moves from left to right. It then reflects from the right side and travels back in the opposite direction. The answer to Jones's question is that the sound both hugs the inside of the curve and skims along the water's surface. Early writers on echoes were keen to find extraordinary multiple echoes with the greatest numbers of repeats, echoes that would turn a ha into laughter. This endeavor was taken to the absurd by the echo collector in Mark Twain's short story, The Canvasser's Tale. You may know, sir, that in the echo market the scale of prices is cumulative, like the carat scale in diamonds. In fact, the same phraseology is used. A single carat echo is worth but $10 over and above the value of the land it is on. A 2-carat or double-barreled echo is worth $30. A 5-carat is worth $950. A 10-carat is worth $13,000. My uncle's Oregon echo, which he called the Great Pitt echo, was a 22-carat gem and cost $216,000. They threw the land in. In the 17th century, the real-life collector and myth-buster Marin Mersenne analyzed the claim that a tower near the Aventine Hill in Rome would repeat the entire first line of Virgil's Aeneid 8 times. Since it takes nearly 40 seconds to hear 8 repeats of the phrase, the farthest reflection would have had to travel a round trip of 14 kilometers, 8.5 miles, which is too far for the voice to carry and still be audible. More believable are the stories about the 16th century Villa Simonetta in Milan. The great 18th century mathematician Daniel Bernoulli stated that he could hear up to 60 repetitions from the echo. Twain wrote about this in his travel book The Innocents Abroad, which includes a plate showing a woman entertaining 2 gentlemen by blasting a trumpet to excite the echo. Iris Lauterbach, writing on Italian gardens, noted that the villa was famous well into the 19th century, but not for its garden. The attraction was an echo. The villa was a rectangular horseshoe shape with 2 large wings, exactly parallel to each other, spaced 34 meters, 110 feet apart. The semi-enclosed courtyard used to open up to a luxuriant garden. On the first floor, there was a single window up near the roof on one of the wings. Speak from this window, and the words would bounce back and forth across the courtyard between the parallel wings. The sound took 0.2 seconds to complete the round trip, which meant a very short blast repeated many times. Old reports claim that a pistol shot would repeat 40 to 60 times. 17th century engravings of the villa show the upper walls of the wings to be very simple flat surfaces, ensuring that the sound could bounce back and forth without being scattered in other directions and lost from the echo path. In the engravings, the echo window looks odd, the only opening on the upper walls of the wings and ruining the architectural symmetry. It makes me wonder whether the window was deliberately placed to take advantage of the acoustic phenomena. Unfortunately, the villa was extensively damaged by bombing during the Second World War, so the courtyard now lacks the grand colonnades and vistas, and disappointingly, the echo has been dulled to a single retort. Is it just me, or is it virtually impossible not to shout and whoop when entering a tunnel? Some are better than others, with the foot tunnel under the Thames near Greenwich, London being one of my favourites. Finished in 1902, it was built to let South London residents walk to work across the river in the Isle of Dogs. I went back there a few months after my trip to France, on a cold winter's night, to see if my childhood memories of the acoustics were right. Despite being a foot tunnel, nearly everyone passing through seemed to be on a bike. I spent some time wandering up and down the 370-meter-long, 400-yard tube. It is a squat cylinder covered in off-white glazed tiles. The poorly lit tunnel is only about 3 meters, 10 feet in diameter. As sound waves bounce back and forth across the width, they tend to distort dramatically. If I stood right in the middle, my voice resounded with a metallic twang. The resonances of the tunnel were over-amplifying certain frequencies in my voice, making it sound unnatural. I asked the sound artist Peter Cusack about his impressions of the place. Sometimes there is a busker in the middle of it, and if you listen from the end, then there's no way of telling what the tune is or even what instrument they are playing. It is just this musical mush that comes up one end, which is actually quite pleasant. And as you walk down the tunnel and get closer and closer, and it becomes clearer and clearer, it is often a bit of a disappointment when you get there. At one point, I was alarmed to hear what I initially thought was an approaching freight train. I was relieved to see it was just the rumble of a skateboard being amplified by the tunnel. After passing me, the skateboarder flipped up his board but missed catching it, causing an impressive clash as though someone were slamming the doors of a large cathedral. The initial crash travelled hundreds of yards to the end wall and returned with an audible echo. The hard, tiled surfaces allow the sound to rattle around the tunnel for a long time before dying away. Engineers at Bradford University, England, have been using the ability of tunnels to carry sound long distances to find obstructions in sewers. Noise is played down the pipe, and a microphone records any echoes heard. The time it takes for the echo to arrive reveals how far away the blockage is, and the acoustic characteristics of the reflection tell the scientists about the size and type of obstruction. One reason tunnels often have impressive acoustics is that sound can travel an unusually long way in them. If someone is talking to you outdoors, the farther apart the two of you are, the quieter the other person sounds. Imagine blowing up a balloon. As it expands, the rubber gets thinner as it spreads over a larger surface area. Being farther from a sound source outdoors is like being on the edge of the balloon. The energy is spread thinly like the balloon's rubber, so it is quieter. But in a tunnel, the acoustic wave is spread across the width of the tube, which does not change in size as you get farther away from the sound source. The only way energy is lost is through absorption by the tunnel walls. If the walls are made of hard materials such as tiles, brick, or sealed concrete, sound can carry for huge distances. Still curious about why my voice sounded so metallic in Greenwich, I sought out another example to experience, one where the effect is even stronger. London Science Museum has a hands-on gallery full of children noisily enjoying science. Across the back wall is a long, sloping industrial tube, 30 meters, 100 feet long, and about 30 centimeters, 12 inches in diameter. "Sounds like gunfire," suggested a young boy just before I started to experiment. This was a good description. A clap of my hands sounded like a cross between a sheet of metal being struck and a laser gun from a sci-fi movie with a slow recoil. It is easy to assume that the tube's material dominates the sound. But while the pipe was made of metal, the material has very little to do with why my voice or clapping developed a robotic quality. The tube could have been made of any hard material, such as concrete, metal, or plastic, and it would still have made a twang, as happened within the tiled Greenwich Foot Tunnel. What is most important is the geometry of the bore, because it is the air that is doing most of the vibrating, not the tube walls. The same confusion exists with musical instruments. I learned the clarinet when I was younger, and the lower notes on the instrument are often described as being distinctly woody, which you might assume comes from the black ebonite tubing. However, my colleague Mark Avis once played a brass clarinet and noticed how remarkably woody that sounds. The great jazz player Charlie Parker famously used a plastic saxophone for some gigs, yet he still created his distinctive sound. Similarly, the brassy blast of a trumpet or trombone might be wrongly attributed to the metal from which it is usually made. Some historic brass instruments, such as the cornetto, were actually made of wood and yet can still make a brassy sound. A musical instrument simultaneously generates many different frequencies, known as harmonics, which give distinct color to the sound. When an oboe plays a tuning note for the orchestra, a concert A at 440 Hz, sound is also produced at 880, 1320, and 1760 Hz. These harmonics are multiples of the fundamental frequency, and their strength depends on the instrument's geometry. When a trombone is played loudly, a shock wave can be created inside the bore similar to that produced by a sonic boom, generating lots of high frequencies. A brassy sound is associated with musical notes that have exceptionally strong high frequencies. The echo tube at the Science Museum has only a few strong harmonics, and these are not simple multiples of the fundamental. Musical instruments sound beautiful because they have been designed to produce harmonics whose frequencies are regularly spaced. Large pieces of metal tend to radiate at irregular frequencies and sound dissonant. Thus, the tube, with its discordant frequencies adds a metallic quality to voices. Another key feature determining a musical instrument's voice is how notes begin and finish. A metal chime bar can ring beautifully for a long time. Similarly, the air in the echo tube at the Science Museum rang on and on. But something else intrigued me about the echo tube. Clapping my hands created a zinging sound, the echo starting at a high frequency and then descending in pitch. I talked to a few colleagues, and they were similarly bemused because none of us expected a shift in frequency in a simple tube. One of the fun things about being a scientist is having your expectations subverted and finding something new to understand. Looking through the literature, I found that the descending zing was a culvert whistler. It was first documented a few decades ago by the late American scientist Frank Crawford, who observed a chirp from a pipe under a sand dune in California. In an effort to explain his observation, reported one article, Crawford has clapped his hands, beat bongo drums, and has banged on pieces of plywood in front of culverts all around the San Francisco Bay Area. If you listen to one end of a culvert while someone claps hands once at the other end, the first sound to arrive travels straight down the middle of the tube following the shortest distance. The next sound to arrive has reflected once off the side wall and so has traveled a little farther. The next sound has hit both sides once while zigzagging down the tube. Later sounds will follow a longer, more jagged path. If you plot these sounds arriving over time, you find that the reflections arrive close together at first and then gradually are spaced farther apart toward the end of the chirp. At any particular instance, the pitch of the chirp is determined by the spacing between adjacent reflections. When reflections arrive rapidly one after another, as happens initially, a high-frequency sound is the result. As the time between reflections increases, the frequency lowers. A similar downward glissando also happens when vibrations pass through a solid like a metal. This might be another reason why the echo tube sounds metallic. Multiple reflections lie at the heart of echoes that create almost musical sounds. Not long after my canoeing trip, on a hot, sunny afternoon in the city of Angoulême in France, I stood outside the comic book museum while inside my children devoured the extensive Asterix and Tintin collections. Bored, I experimented with clapping and listening to the reflection from the front of the building, a wide, low, and white converted warehouse that had been used to store cognac. But it was the reflection from another structure that caught my attention. There was a high-pitched sound to my right, like someone squeezing a squeaky toy, coming from a staircase. A tonical echo. Boredom turned to an afternoon of fevered experimentation as I recorded and documented the strange reflection from this short flight of stairs. What I was hearing was the same phenomenon that creates the chirping Mayan pyramids described in Chapter 2. Staircases can make many different sounds. Acoustic engineer Nico de Klerk wrote to me about a quacking staircase. It is on the Menik Ganga, Gem River in Sri Lanka, a river you must cross in order to reach the sanctuary of Katharagama. When you cross the water, you can hear quacking ducks when you clap your hands or when women hit rocks with clothes they are washing. Back in Europe, artist Davide Titone popped balloons to reveal the unusual acoustics of the Austrian city of Linz, including an explosive wheezing sound created by a very long staircase. The strange sounds are made by the pattern of reflections from the treads of the stairs, which distort the sound of the balloon pop or clap, and this pattern can be explained by geometry. The frequency drops by about an octave because the spacing between the reflections roughly doubles. The particular sound reflected from a staircase depends on where the clapper stands, as well as on the size and number of steps. The squeaky stairs outside the comic book museum were quite short and did not have enough reflections to create the extended sound of a chirping bird. The longest staircase in the world runs alongside the funicular railway up the Niesen, a mountain in Switzerland. It is open to the public only once a year for a marathon, and the winner takes about an hour to climb the 11,674 steps. When I simulated the staircase in an acoustic model, it sounded like a wheezy air horn. If you're looking for a staircase to experiment on, I would suggest finding one in a quiet place away from other reflecting surfaces. It does not have to be very long, maybe 20 steps, but the more stair treads there are, the more impressive the effect will be. Archaeologists argue about the role of staircases on the size of Mayan pyramids and whether they were built to imitate the chirp of a quetzal bird. Leaving aside this debate, what other sounds could the Mayans have made if they had built the stairs differently? The sound reflected from a flight of stairs is determined by the pattern of reflections that build up as a clap bounces off each stair tread and returns to the listener. In a normal staircase, the later reflections arrive farther apart than the earlier ones, causing a chirp that descends in frequency. Imagine a staircase constructed by bad builders, one in which the steps are not all the same size. At the bottom of the stairs, the steps get smaller and smaller as they go up, creating a series of reflections that are heard with a rising pitch. Then, toward the top, the steps stretch out and get bigger and bigger to create a quick drop in the pitch. With just the right pattern of steps between about 3 and 10 centimeters, 1 to 4 inches wide, you can get a chirp that rises and then falls in frequency. In other words, the staircase would make a wolf whistle. A completely useless staircase, but what a sonic wonder it would be! While the embellishment of my voice by a tunnel was not pleasant, it explains why old writings on tonical echoes observe voices modulated into distinct tones. Clapping near a staircase shows how reflections outdoors can sound like a distinct musical note. Occasionally, the old echo tales are fanciful, with the most unlikely one featuring a tune being played on trumpet that resounds at a lower pitch. A change in pitch flouts the laws of physics, but then so does the phrase, "A duck's quack doesn't echo," and people seem happy to keep repeating that. Maybe the trumpet echo was a simple practical joke, or maybe the basis is a more subtle tonal coloration that has just been over-embellished as the story is retold. No matter how powerful an echo is, or what type it may be, all the echoes described in this chapter have one thing in common. They can be enjoyed with just one ear, that is, they are monaural delights. Let's turn now to binaural sonic wonders, those that mess with how our brains use two ears to localize sound.